Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Welcome, 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 everyone. My name is Neeraj Chaudhary, sitting in today for Peter Schiff. I'm an investment consultant at the Los Angeles branch of Euro Pacific Capital, and is my great sincere pleasure to be joining you today. Co-hosting with me today is my branch manager and a close personal friend of Peter Schiff's for a quarter of a century, Hemant Kathuria, my branch manager. Hemant, are you with us today?
Yes, I am. How are you doing, Neeraj?
Pretty good. How are you today?
Good. Great day to do a radio show. I was talking to Peter about 15 minutes ago, and he was talking about the campaign and all the different things he's been doing. He's running around. As you may have heard, now he's a regular on CNBC Fast Money. He's going to be doing that twice a week. I was watching it yesterday, and the cool thing about it is they're all like, yes, Peter has said all the right stuff. His predictions are better than any of the other people we've been bringing on this show. We should listen to Peter Schiff. And, you know, it's good to see mainstream media come around and start understanding that the person with no agenda, the person with that can take the hard knocks, the person that can understand what is going to happen actually before it happens, go out there, put it out on the line, archive everything on the website, 7 years of data as far as commentary, all the videos, not afraid of his track record at all, and takes on all comers. That's the guy that they want on Fast Money, and I'm glad. I mean, they're finally starting to get it. They smirk, they look, they have that kind of expression. But you know what? You can tell if you look carefully at the different hosts on the show. They have the respect now. They said, okay, this guy made the tough calls. He didn't go out and just say buy the S&P 500. He said, this is what you need to buy. This is why you need to buy it.
Right.
And so it's all good. I mean, it's an exciting time to be with Euro Pacific Capital. It's an exciting time to see what Peter Schiff is doing in the campaign. And in general, we like to see that the advice that we've been giving clients over the last decade has really proven out. And,
absolutely. You know, just on the topic of advice, I want to start out the show just by reminding people that everything that we talk about, all the investments do involve risk. All investments can lose money, whether you're in the United States or overseas, and not all investments are suitable for all investors. And we strongly recommend that you consult your investment consultant, whether at Euro Pacific Capital or at your current firm. We hope you join us. But regardless of such, it's best to consult your financial advisor, your investment consultant, to best determine which investments are suitable for you. If you are a Euro Pacific client or are interested in becoming a Euro Pacific client, you're more than welcome to call our 800 number. That number is 800-727-7922, where you can discuss what kinds of things we specifically do and whether or not those things are suitable.
And if you're on the West Coast, you can also call directly into the L.A. branch at 310-826-2975. That is
absolutely
something where if you're in the late hours and you're on West Coast, or even if you're in Hawaii, that is a number where you will get a live person picking it up.
Absolutely. Hemant, I know you're a bit of a metals bug, a gold and silver bug. There's been a lot of conversation the last day or so about how the Dow is staying above 10,000, and isn't it great that the NASDAQ has made a new high for this particular move up to the mid-2300s? But I know that you and I tend to follow these things on a longer time horizon, and also we look at things in terms of real money, i.e. gold. What are some of the research indicators on that?
You look at it. You look back over the last decade, and I think this was something I touched upon in the radio show, which was actually the last radio show of the last decade. When Peter came in on the second half of the show, we were talking back and forth about this and how that the U.S. market has completely underperformed the BRIC countries. Now I want to talk about the U.S. market in terms of real money, which, of course, there is only one real money that has been considered for the last 5,000 years, gold. And it's an amazing way to look at things. The gold in March 10th of year 2000 was $291 an ounce. March 10th of 2010, it's at $1,121. That's a 285% 10-year gain.
So, amazing.
You know, you can easily divide that out. That's 28.5% a year. Now, what did the Dow during that same period? Well, it was up a total, cumulative, 6.4%. So 9,929 in March of 2000, 10,567 today. I think the way to measure the Dow in terms of gold is a good way to look at it. It's been bouncing around. As you know, the Dow was in a massive bear market in terms of real money. Last time we had a situation like this, the Dow eventually bottomed out at one times gold, which I think is doable. I mean, people are going to laugh at me. They're going to think that that it can't happen. Well, there's the same people that would have laughed when the Dow Jones was trading at 30 or 40 or even 50 ounces of gold. I mean, think back to March 10, 2000, when Dow Jones was 34 ounces of gold. 10 years later, now the Dow Jones is 9.4 ounces of gold. That's a 72% decline in real terms. I mean, that's
amazing.
That is scary. The funny thing is, though, it's even more impressive when you compare it to the NASDAQ. Where today is the 10-year anniversary of the all-time high in the NASDAQ. We were well over 5,000. March 10th, 2000, 5,049 on the NASDAQ. March 10th, 2010, 10 years later, 2,359. So a 10-year performance, negative 53%. In real terms, down 88%.
Wow.
That's
those
astounding.
Are great depression
over a 10-year
numbers,
period,
aren't they?
If you bought the 401k favorites, the mutual fund favorites, the names that you all know, That's the kind of return. Now, did you get the dividend? No. NASDAQ doesn't pay any dividends. I mean, very, very small, puny dividends in some cases. There's a few companies out there that have added dividends. And once again, due to all the various viewers that are listening to the show in different countries and different time zones, each person's specifics are different. So I'm not going to go out and mention specific stock names. It's just probably not appropriate for a show with a broad reach such as this, but you know the names I'm talking about. And so that brings it all home. This, if you do not have an account with Euro Pacific Capital, I got one question to ask you. Why? Why haven't you just picked up the phone? I mean, what is holding you back? These figures are hard. This is hard data. Whether you compare it to the BRIC countries, whether you compare it to physical gold, whether you compare it to silver, all of these things have done well. Real stuff has done well. I can make the same analogy going out with platinum, going out with oil. The situation,
silver.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was looking at a chart the other day, which is describing silver prices, housing, U.S. housing prices in terms of silver. Amazing, amazing chart. And there are all kind of documented things out there which show that the investments that Peter Schiff has been telling his clients to accumulate, buy all dips. I mean, how many times have you heard Peter say that he says that every dip in the mining sector is a buying opportunity? Now, of course,
right.
You know, mining stocks are volatile. They typically don't pay yields. You don't want to have a full portfolio of mining stocks. But, I mean, for a small portion of your portfolio, you can get a lot of good inflation protection. So that's it's something to definitely consider. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on in the news. Neeraj, you want to touch upon the jobs bill?
Well, yeah. You know, the Senate has just passed another $149 billion jobs bill. And meanwhile, all that's happening to the unemployment rate is that it keeps going up and up and up and up. This jobs bill is going to extend unemployment benefits and increase tax breaks for businesses and so on and so forth. All the government is doing is making the entire situation worse. You know, everyone forgets that the government cannot create any jobs. That's not the role of government. The role of government is to interfere in private markets, misallocate resources. The fact of the matter is 40% of people who are unemployed right now have been unemployed for at least 6 months. This is unprecedented. You know, the numbers, Hemanth, as you were talking about, the Dow in real terms being down 72% and the NASDAQ in real terms being down 88%, that those are Great Depression-style numbers as far
absolutely.
As evaporation of paper wealth. And
it's absolutely
really
correct.
Correlates.
I mean, I was looking at writing an article, which we might post on the website in the you know next several weeks, and the title of the article was going to be something about the disconnect between Main Street and Wall Street. So I'm kind of firming up some ideas and putting them down on paper. Yeah. But think about it this way. This branch is similar to other businesses. We have expenses. We have payroll. We have utilities. We have parking. You know, all the normal stuff, L.A. business tax, et cetera. So it's a perfect example of what we have to go through on a daily basis to generate jobs, generate income, generate that circulation in the economy. We have to make very good decisions on a daily basis. Those decisions are things that politicians are unable to do. And
right.
so they cannot see it from the ground floor. And the unfortunate thing is that the Wall Street guys also don't get it. And that's the amazing thing. A lot of the guys
well,
in Wall Street...
You know why the Wall Street guys don't get it is because Wall Street, look at the Dow Jones. The Dow Jones is up 6.5% over 10 years. Not great, but these guys get to pocket multi-million dollar pay packages because
sure.
They're in nominal terms. Their Dow Jones is up 6.4%. But in real terms, when you talk about the disconnect between Main Street and Wall Street, when you have 40% of people who have been unemployed for 6 months, that's the disconnect. So
absolutely. I mean, those are the same people that are supposedly supposed to be in those shopping malls buying
right.
those consumer goods. And I'm sitting here looking out my window here on Wilshire, and another, you know, fine sunny day in Southern California. I'm happy to be here. But the point I want to make is I'm looking across the way to the building across the street. I see a lot of vacant offices over there. I was talking to one of the neighbors here in the adjoining offices, and we were talking about the what's happening. And it's retrenchment all across the board. Now, all these vacant
right.
offices, for every single vacant window, that is a potential consumer. So you've got a retrenchment all across the board, yet the publicly traded vehicles, the real estate investment trust that actually that these buildings are a part of, on Wall Street, those things are rallying. People are buying them for the yield. I mean, how many times have you heard that before? They
right.
have no concept of risk versus reward. The risk is being in the dollar. The risk is being in overly levered, bad-managed U.S. companies. The risk is not knowing what you own. Now, that sounds like a real simple concept, and people think that there is a big mystery into investing, and it really those managers really know their stuff. You know what? I don't buy it. I talk to real business people every day. They're my clients. I'm sure you do the exact same thing with your clients, and they call with real, logical questions. And if it doesn't make sense, it usually there's probably something wrong. And so when you talk about it and you see 30% of the building next door vacant, that's not a kind of something that I want to be invested in. And so this is the simple kind of analysis that any man on the street can do. But the Wall Street guys, they want to try to confuse the issue with their numbers and their statistics and say, well, on a forward basis, this is okay. We can buy this. And
well, they're,
you know,
they're getting distorted by their bailout packages. In their world, when they make a bad decision, they just go to Uncle Sam, and Uncle Sam writes them a big check, and they go on. They get a bailout. They get a huge pay package, and it's on to the next bad decision.
Well, exactly. I mean, I live in an area in the Palos Verdes Estates, and my neighbors, the associates, the people that you see in the cocktail parties, I was joking about this to a client today, and I was saying sometimes the cocktail party discussion gets a little bit heated. I mean, I'm the guy who's been telling these guys to just, you know, dump your U.S. stocks and buy gold for the last decade. They don't want to hear it. So you've got the same exact situation there that you have in the overall economy. These guys have made their money in financial type investments. They've made it in real estate. All that stuff has not worked for 10 years, and we're going on probably another 10 years, and they still don't want to hear it. So, you know, let's see. Do we have any callers, Neeraj?
We do. You know, first up on the line is Grayson in Colorado. Good evening and welcome to the show. How are you tonight?
Good, guys. How's it going out there?
Pretty good. Pretty good. What can we do for you today?
I was just kind of curious of, you know, following you guys for a long time and thinking about the markets that are going on. Actually, it's my wife's question.
Sure.
If say down the road something happens with the dollar, we have to default or we have to dilute the value of the dollar. Say we've got monies in Hong Kong market or something like that. What is the risk of countries that we owe a lot of money to locking down accounts that are abroad, that sort of thing? I was wondering is there a risk to something like that if we had our money say in the Chinese market or something, and we go bad as a government and don't pay what we owe them. Is there a risk to losing individual investors' monies abroad on something like that?
I guess the scenario that you're contemplating is a scenario where the United States formally defaults on our obligations, and in retaliation for that, foreign banks, or I should say foreign governments, retaliate by freezing the assets of U.S. private citizens. Is that kind of the scenario that you're contemplating?
Exactly. Or if it were a you know, some sort of a conflict or something like that, you've got your money out there in another country. Yeah, exactly. That kind of ideology or that thought process.
You know, I was raised to say never say never. you know, is it in theory a possibility that foreign governments could retaliate against Americans if the American government formally defaults on our obligations? It is absolutely a possibility. I think it would be foolish for anyone to say that that's not a possibility, and that is one of the risks of being invested abroad. But having said that, the consensus amongst virtually everyone that I've spoken to is that the United States will not formally default on our obligations. We will informally default on our obligations through inflation. Now, this is one of the things that Greenspan just loves to point out, which is that U.S. dollars are only of value to the extent that they are in short supply. If you go back and read his speech from 2002 before he became chairman.
Fed chair.
Yeah, Fed chair. You know, he talks about the fact that he basically lays out what a central bank can do to prop up an economy and basically talks about what he says a money finance tax cut, and effectively it's inflation. So I think it's unlikely that you're going to see the United States formally default on our obligations. I think it's more likely that we're going to inflate our way out of our obligations. And under that scenario, I think it's more likely that foreign governments will sell off their treasury holdings rather than trying to retaliate against private citizens. It could go down that way, but right now, in a fiat currency world, it doesn't look like that's where we're headed. Let's go now to Rich in Nevada. Rich, how are you doing today?
Good, good. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good,
pretty good.
Where are you in Nevada?
Las Vegas.
Las Vegas. Great city.
Yeah. Tough economically here now, but it's a nice city, nice place to live. I like it. I like it, except for the economics.
Did they get the city center all taken care of, or is that still something that's kind of
I have a friend who works there who said that they're talking about layoffs. So at least amongst the staff. So I think it's tough times. Tough times.
Sure.
But, appreciate you guys taking my call, and wanted to hit on something that you were just talking about. If you could please discuss the factors that you think will either increase or decrease the yield on T-bills over the next few years, the next 5 years, the next year.
You want to take that one, Neeraj, or should I take it?
Sure. Well, you know, at the end of the day, what is a yield? What is an interest rate on a bond? It's simply the price of the bond at which there are enough buyers and sellers to transact the bonds that are in the market. So if the U.S. government is trying to sell, I think we just sold, $21 billion worth of 10-year paper today. We did it in the mid-2s.
Right.
It just means that...
The 10-year is actually in the mid-3s.
It was in the mid-3s. Yeah, my mistake.
Yeah.
All that means is that the federal government had to pay a certain interest rate in order to attract enough buyers to the bond auction to sell all the paper that it wanted to sell. So if you look now at, a 10-year rate or a 30-year rate, it's really just the same principle. The question is, what is effectively the price that the government needs to pay in order to borrow money for 10 years or for 30 years? If market conditions are favorable and the government has a strong balance sheet and a low debt-to-GDP ratio and a strong currency and some other good factors, then it can pay a low interest rate. If those factors are negative, if we have a high debt-to-GDP ratio, a slow-growth economy, high taxation, and some other issues with our economy, unfunded liabilities as we do in this country, then the government's going to have to pay a higher interest rate to attract that money. So in terms of the factors that are going to lead to it, really it's just the market's assessment of whether or not they're going to get paid back and what level of risk they perceive in that asset and how much money they want to be compensated for risking that that loan.
We've also got the factor that we are the world's reserve currency, so we have that advantage because so much business is conducted worldwide in dollars that
right.
The people tend to want to hold reserves in dollars, and that has driven down the market rate for the 10-year T-note and the 30-year T-bond. But the short-term
rate,
which is
the T-bill rate, that's not going to
last. Well, of course. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that every country throughout history that has been the world's reserve currency has ended up abusing it, and we're in that exact same process right now. So, and you know, part of that abuse is the Fed monetizing the debt. They're coming out,
right.
Treasury issuing debt, indirect buyers are coming in either through London or through the Caribbean, and there's no way to prove it, but the anecdotal evidence suggests that a lot of this is coming directly from the Fed. So it's newly created money buying the same debt that the Treasury is issuing, and of course that's going to push down the dollar, which is the whole process of abusing our status as having the world's reserve currency. And the T-bill rate, which is the ultra short-term rate, that is something where they're in the biggest bind because there's so much debt still out there, which is indexed to short-term rates. And so the Fed having to keep that rate at zero, which is, of course, inflationary, is stuck. They can't raise the rate because all that indexed short-term debt will go to a higher rate, which will further constrict economic activity. And so all they can do is jawbone, and that's what they've been doing right now. It's trying to state that there's no inflation, which, of course, is false. You've got the increase in supply of money and credit, which is the real inflation. Just because we don't have the effects of that inflation in the immediate term doesn't mean that the inflation is not in the pipeline. In fact, I would argue it's baked in the cake. I mean, I think it was Jim Rogers who said that we have an inflationary holocaust on the horizon, and I tend to agree with him.
And I mean, everything you're saying is everything I'm thinking, which is that the yield is almost certainly got to go up, barring some catastrophic, you know, unforeseen event. But don't
Correct.
You think the yield is going to have to go up on these?
We just came off of a bull market in Treasury bonds, 30 years long. Okay, so the secular bottom is going to prove out to be in 2008. So in 1980 to 2008, 28 years of falling interest rates. So you had a 28-year bull market. What do you think the next direction is? Well, it's going to be a lengthy bear market. It could be very, very long.
Period.
And that's going to be rising rates.
Period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So no,
how soon do you guys
doubt,
think it'll
no
happen?
Doubt in
do you think
our
it's going to happen
no
pretty quickly
mind,
in a year or a few years or 10 years? Or?
Don't worry about the time frame. Worry about the direction. I mean,
yeah.
The direction is up. Be prepared for that. So if you've got
right.
some adjustable rate debt you want to lock in, you know, you can lock that in at a low rate, which is partially subsidized by your own tax dollars. lock that in, and you have your own personal carry trade. I mean, there you're borrowing an inflating currency at a fixed rate. So, I mean, that's a situation where it might make sense. Of course, I don't know your personal situation, so do the usual stuff. Contact your tax advisor, contact your real estate agent, contact your mortgage broker. Check all that stuff out for yourself and see if that makes sense for you. But yeah, in general terms, the rates are headed higher.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Have a great evening. The phone number for calling into tonight's show, we are taking calls live, is 888-678-9597. We are going to be here for the rest of the hour. We're sitting in for Peter Schiff. Hammett, you said you spoke with Peter earlier today. What's he doing today? Is he involved in some campaign events? What's the story?
Well, one thing I wanted to talk about is actually I was talking to Martha. She's managing the financial side of his campaign.
That's right, the fundraiser.
We're going to be having a fundraiser here in Beverly Hills. So if anybody listening out there is a local L.A. person and wants to help support the Schiff for Senate campaign, just give me a call or give Neeraj a call, and we'll give you the details. The debate that he had the other day, this was in Connecticut, broadcast live. It is on YouTube. It's gotten a lot of hits. The response to that has been overwhelmingly in favor of Peter's viewpoints. I mean, there were some polls done about who won the debate, and clearly, hands down, Peter Schiff was the winner. He was the only guy really making a lot of sense. The type of things that the other candidates were saying were literally canned responses that their handlers have told them. And Peter, much more relaxed, is saying things that he truly believes and understands. I mean, that's really the sticking point here, is if you're a candidate for office, and most likely you'll be sitting in some type of committee in the Senate, which will be making financial decisions, wouldn't you want that candidate to be somebody who actually understands the decisions he's making? I mean, it seems like a very basic concept, but if you look at the Chris Dodds of the world, career politicians who have been in office for forever, they have one goal, is to just get reelected. So now, when the writing was on the wall that he could not get reelected, he brought in Blumenthal, and with the higher ratings to give the likes of Peter Schiff a real run for his money. But I think that the public groundswell is coming our direction. They understand that the economic things that Peter has been talking about over the last decade are not just theoretical. This is real world. This is our future. This is our kids' liabilities that they'll be paying for generations and generations. I mean, the $80 trillion of unfunded liabilities between Social Security and Medicare, this is real. This is tangible. It's something that we're seeing right now. I mean, where I live, you see a lot of more demand now for private schools because of all the cutbacks in the public schools. So it's happening on the ground floor. You're talking about four-day school weeks going forward in a lot of places around the country. You're seeing evidence of all the problems that were passed on from generation to generation, and from these same career politicians. You know what? Just push it back to the next person and then be done with it. Well, it's too late for that right now. Hard decisions need to be made. You think that Greece was bad? You ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, California is the harbinger of what's happening in the United States. 12.5% unemployment plus. The real unemployment rate is well north of 20%, and the writing is on the wall. Peter gets that, but a lot of these other people out there, to them, it's still theory, and that is
right. Scary.
I mean, it's downright scary.
It is. Let's go to Eric in New York. Good evening. Thank you for being patient, Eric, and welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. You're doing a great job so far.
Thank you.
My question is about China. And, Peter's talked a lot about China and how their economy is booming and so on and so forth. But given that China, at least as of a year ago or so, a heavily export-oriented economy, given that in late 2008 it, fell into the tank with the rest of the world economy, given that its exports fell heavily, would you say that since the Chinese government's answer to that to that collapse has been just a massive credit creation, a credit stimulus package, instead of, like Peter had been advocating for so long, to pull the peg on the currency. Do you not think that all the resultant, let's call it production or recuperation in the Chinese economy, is not a bubble?
Nir, do you want to take that one, or should I take it?
Well, no, you can go right ahead, Hemant.
Okay, you know what? Let's talk about China. Let's talk about the U.S. Now, what happened in 2008? What is the best example that we could look at in our own history? And you know what? I'm going to point to World War II. I'm going to point to an entire nation's output producing bombs, ships, planes, bullets, guns. Everything that essentially you could argue is non-productive. And then you had the war end. You had troops coming back, no jobs, entire manufacturing base set up for producing essentially nothing that can be used. These people were out of work. The factories had to be retooled, and we had a recession. Well, guess what happened? We did retool those factories. Those people were put back to work. Those factories were redirected to other productive uses. And then what happened? We had the greatest boom in both domestic consumption and exports in our nation's history. Now, one of the facets that was probably key during that period of time is that our debt to GDP coming out of World War II was an extremely high rate. Now, you think back to today and fast forward to the 2008 experience in China, and I think you're going to see the parallels that I'm drawing here. You had an entire manufacturing base output going to produce essentially junk. I mean, I'm talking about kids' toys. I'm talking about that extra pair of Uggs or Crocs or whatever the other stuff my daughter's always wanting me to buy. I'm talking about different kind of things that are really not creating anything. All they're doing is going to a debt-fueled boom, exports going into the U.S. So they're creating all this stuff and essentially not really getting anywhere with it. Now, what has happened? Well, 2008 came along. American consumer had all of a sudden found out the ATM machine was shut off. No way to borrow money from that home equity line of credit. No way to refinance that mortgage. No way to borrow any more money. So when it comes to Christmas and your kid wants the G.I. Joe with a Kung Fu grip, well, they're out of luck. So what happened is Chinese factories had to lay off people. They shut down. They sent people back to the farms. And the Chinese government came to a decision. Well, it's time to start going into the war chest. Now, what is the war chest? It was the $2 trillion of money that they had accumulated over the previous decade, just precisely for the moment when it came time to take their economy and start transforming it from an export powerhouse into more of a domestic consumption hybrid export economy. And that's exactly what's happening. You've seen the type of businesses totally changed there. You see now, instead of people, Chinese businessmen copycat, mimicking type of innovation done elsewhere, that they're actually doing innovation themselves. There are new ideas coming out of China, new products coming out of China, and there is manufacturing coming out of China. But the difference is this. This is all coming with money, cash, reserves that they have accumulated.
They saved for a rainy day.
Yeah, exactly. This is not borrowed money. This is money that they had already prepared. They already knew this was coming. You think about today, you talk about the renminbi, you say it's undervalued. Okay, we agree with you. Now, are you going to invest in China only after the renminbi is 30% higher? I'm going to get invested in some good Chinese income ideas, some stocks that are trading at 4 and 5 times earnings while their brethren in the U.S. are trading at triple those kind of valuations. I'm going to invest in stocks that are growing and get in there before the currency is revalued. Now, that currency is going to be revalued, mark my words. A couple of years ago, it was illegal to hold certain types of metal in China. Now, Chinese state-run TV is saying go out to your bank and buy gold and buy silver. You know what? You can go to a Chinese bank and buy gold at about 4 to 5% over spot. That is something that citizens are actually being encouraged to do at this point. Why? Why is that? Well, that 1/10 of 1 ounce, which is the average per capita holdings in the Chinese citizen of gold, they want to take that up, and they are going to take that up. 5 years from now, we'll find out how much the Chinese have put into their own gold reserves today. They're not going to tell you now. They're not going to tell you next year. You're going to find out, though. You'll find out when after their gold reserves have gone up tenfold. So,
right.
You know, that's the story. That is what's going on in China. You need to look at all sides of the coin. If John Downs, who is my assistant manager, if he was on the phone with you, he's sitting in Shanghai right now, and he has co-hosted the show from Shanghai. If he was on the phone, he would say that it's one of the most dynamic places he's ever been. In fact, I talk to him every day. One of the reasons he went there is so he can actually see with his own eyes. He can actually visit the companies. He can actually talk to the management, see that these things are real. This is a real story. This is not a one-year flash in the pan. This is a generational story. It is a shift. It is a rise of standards of living across the globe, led by China, and is coupled with a decrease in the standard of living for the average American. So get on board. I mean, there's plenty of ways to play it. You know, call into your Europac broker. If you do not have an account, well, you should get started today.
Agreed. Couldn't agree more. Let's go to Brent in the lovely state of Hawaii. How are you doing, Brent? I think everyone's probably envious of you already being in the great state of Hawaii. How are things going out there?
It's windy and rainy today, so.
Oh, well, I won't say that I'm happy to hear that. Welcome to the show. What can we do for you today?
Thank you. Well, I have a question. I finished reading Crash Proof 2.0 back in January.
Right.
One of the things that Peter said in the book that I didn't understand was he was referring to the Enron debacle and the accounting practices that they were engaged in, and suggested that if Enron had been required to pay dividends, that would have prevented them from engaging in some of those accounting practices. But I didn't understand why that was the, you know.
Can you explain why that would have prevented them? Yeah, that's a great question. Peter's point about dividends, to me, is probably the single most powerful reason that he is the kind of as well-known as he is today, which is that you can't fake dividends. You can fake inflation. You can suppress the gold price with the Washington Agreement. You can play games with speculation. You can have the plunge protection team come in at 3:30 and buy the dips and have the market close flat or even a little higher, but you can't fake dividends. Dividends are paid out of income. Income is the basic profitability of the company. So if you've got some of the large cap tech names that Hemant was alluding to earlier, or if you've got a company that's now bankrupt like Enron that is posting so-called profits but is not paying any of those profits out to shareholders in the form of dividends, well, then you can look at those profits, those so-called profits, and wonder, is that for real or not? But if you have a
company
that...
Let me add to that. I mean, what Enron was doing is they were showing profits by having off-the-balance sheet partnerships. So what they
right.
would do is they would shunt the liabilities off the balance sheet, and that way, if something didn't work out, no problem. We'd stick it in a separate vehicle, and that way we can always show profit growth. And the point that Neeraj made is exactly the reason why you have to focus on the dividend, because forget about what the headline PE is. I want to know what the cash flow is. I want to see that cash coming in and see what the payout ratio is of that cash. The reason that we focus on regular businesses, I'm talking about an energy trust and gold mines and agricultural companies, is because you can understand how the business is making money. It's not that we're derivatives traders and we're leveraging 20 to 1 like Enron was done. I mean, if you look back even to the recent history, one of the points that I'm gonna make is that it never changes. The more things stay the same, it just keeps on repeating itself. Think about another company, and I probably can't even mention the name. I was going to, but then I realized that my compliance department will probably not like it. So I'll just say it was a Southern California-based real estate company, and this is in 2005. those big articles in the Wall Street Journal about this particular company, and what they were doing is exactly the same thing that Enron was doing. They had land that they had bought at the exact top of the market. And what they did is, rather than write down the value of that land, which is what you have to do, real estate is your primary business. Mm-hmm. So if the value of the land drops, you're supposed to write it down. Well, they wouldn't. They would shunt that land into an off-the-balance sheet partnership to hold the land. And that way they could keep showing gains.
Okay.
So this is a trick that is done and is typical of the shenanigans that the Wall Street guys do. You know, all the Wall Street banks had buy ratings on this particular stock. And it's, you know, it doesn't mean that there's a few bad apples. I think this is really indicative of what's going on in corporate America, and the reason that you need to focus on free cash flow, look at the balance sheet, look at the debt of the companies. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, as a branch manager, I'm required to approve the portfolios that go out to the clients. So if any broker in the branch sends out a portfolio, I got to look at it first, and all this stuff has to be plugged in together. I mean, we construct portfolios at Euro Pacific Capital, which are a hybrid of the boring utilities, which might have some debt on the balance sheet, and the debt-free Asian companies, which, you know, Asians love cash. I mean, it's smart. You ride out the bad times with your cash. And then we take the precious metals companies and the different type of oil companies, et cetera. But not only do we look for sector diversification and country diversification, but we also look for these type of things. Well, this company might be carrying a little bit more debt. We don't want to have another company just like it. We go really into that much detail and make sure that that we really find you something that's suitable to you.
No, I do already have a Europac account.
Great.
Oh, great.
So you're preaching to the choir.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad then.
Yeah, I started back to college at the beginning of this year, and I've been taking economics. I'm in macroeconomics now, and one of the things that I've noticed in the textbook and the curriculum is it's basically all Keynesian.
Mm-hmm.
There's virtually no mention of Hayek or von Mises or
you know what you should
other...
do is check out UFM. I mean, when I went down to Latin America, I lectured at Universidad Francisco Marroquín. They actually focus on Austrian economics. They have the Milton Friedman Library, and they have the Atlas Shrugged statue. It's really cool. I mean, there are people out there who do get it. I mean, there are a few people here, a few universities in the United States also that focus, which in our way of thinking, that there is no two types of economics, that Austrian economics is economics and the rest are imposters. But not many people really want to look in that direction, because that would say that all this fractional reserve lending and all the type of priming the pump and the type of thing that the Greenspan started with, really just trying to print your way out of the boom bust cycles. And actually, in fact, what he's doing is creating more boom bust cycles. But anyway, the point I'm making is they don't want to look in that direction, because that would imply that everything that they know and believe is actually totally false. And so, yes, you are going to get the universities teaching this type of economic doctrines, and, you know, it's unfortunate.
Let's go to Jim in Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show. This is Wall Street Unspun.
Oh, hi. How are you? Thanks for
pretty
taking
good.
My
how
call.
Are you doing?
Good, thanks. I'm out here north of Pittsburgh, kind of near 30 miles south of Grove City, where they have an economics department that teaches Austrian economics.
Oh,
very
terrific.
Nice.
But at any rate, you were just talking about the debt and how much money they, but like they don't even make it easy to know. Right, I'm sure that's deliberate. Where, how can you find, you know, the numbers? How much debt from the Treasury the Fed actually buys? What's the number? How can you keep track of it?
You can't.
You know something? You can't.
Indirect buyers.
Because, that's right. You're 100% right when you say they make it so hard to figure out what the true obligations are of the United States. You
well,
got a
I
measure
read somewhere,
called
now they call it they there's this catch-all thing called household is where they dump it all?
Well, you've got several measures. You've got what they call debt held by the public, which is marketable securities. You've got gross debt, which includes all funded liabilities. You've got the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare. And then, oh, by the way, you've got another $5 trillion or so of guaranteed obligations of Fannie and Freddie. That was snuck in the back door on Christmas Eve. Now, for those of you who were just trying to enjoy a nice evening with your families, the federal government was hard at work guaranteeing more of your taxpayer dollars to people making bad decisions, bad economic decisions. So I would argue that the funded debt of this country represents a very small fraction of the total obligations of the federal government. If you include the funded obligations of the U.S. Treasury, the guaranteed agency debt of Fannie Freddie, the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare, and God only knows what's next. I assume the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation will be backing their debt, and probably the FDIC, and let's start adding up the list. It could be well over $100 trillion. So the part of the problem is that we are in so much debt from so many different aspects of our economy, so many different parts of our government, that it's almost immeasurable. The household number that you're referring to probably refers to private household debt, which is effectively owned by the same group of people. The people in the United States that have taken on debt in the private sector are the same people as the taxpayers on whose behalf the government is taking on public sector debt. So if you add together private sector debt and public sector debt, you get somewhere close to 400% of GDP, which is much higher than what it took to bring the country down and start the Great Depression. So the numbers are absolutely unfathomable. They cannot be understood by a normal person, and it just speaks to how much, I would say, corruption is taking place at the government level, because they hide these debt, a trillion here, a trillion there. They hide these obligations in a lot of different drawers and a lot of different pockets, and all of a sudden you reach into your pocket and you're like, hey, wait a minute, we owe another $1 trillion because we're backing up this group, we're backing up that group. You know, Schwarzenegger, the rhino in California, tried to go to Obama and say, hey, we need your help to back up more of California's debt, which to President's credit, he did not do. I'm thankful that he didn't do it. But it's just a giant Ponzi scheme waiting to collapse, unfortunately.
I saw a news stories today is what the state of Illinois says they've got an $11 billion hole and they got to either borrow money or raise taxes.
That's right. California, Illinois, New York, these are the three biggest states. There's also, by the way, people don't even talk about this, there's also the unfunded pension and benefit liabilities at the state level, which are estimated recently at about $3 trillion. I'll bet you that number's higher, and guess who's going to be footing the bill. But thank you very much, Jim, for calling in on an unfortunate note, but that is where we are. Jake in North Carolina, welcome to the show. Welcome to Wall Street Unspun. You're on the air with Neeraj Chaudhary and Hemanth Kothuria in the Los Angeles branch.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I know you were talking before about dividends, but I have a question about the effect of inflation on dividends. I understand now that, you know, as long as China continues to debase their currency at the same rate we are, logically you would think that the dividends are going to adjust as well because it's the same currency. But once they decouple their currency from the dollar, does that mean that since the dollar is inflating, as far as your dollar payments go, your payments are going to increase? Or is it, let's say, before it takes, you know, say 4 units of their currency, the renminbi, to purchase something, and now suddenly since it's become more valuable, it only takes 2 units. Does that mean that essentially your dollar dividend transfer is going to be the same dollar amount, or is it actually going to go up because of our inflation, even though their currency is becoming more valuable and it's a Chinese investment?
Well, if you look at a dividend payment or a stock price or any other measure in a foreign currency, and you look at that number relative to what you're going to get in U.S. dollars, you got to remember that the U.S. dollar, if it declines as we believe it will, and we think it's going to happen sooner rather than later, it has to drop against something. So, as you said, if today the U.S. dollar index is at a level of in the low 80s, and in the future we think that that index is going to go, say, into the 30s, that means that the dollar is going to drop relative to something else. It's going to drop relative to other currencies.
Right.
So if you own, say, a utility that's denominated in, say, Australian dollars, just as an example, if you choose Australia's largest utility, which I think right now is probably paying just below 4%, it's an interesting company. And let's just say that you fast forward and tomorrow the dollar has dropped by 50%. Whatever yield you were getting in Australian dollar terms, you're still going to get. That's a function of the health of the business in Australia. Once you get that yield, then you translate it back into U.S. dollar terms. If the dollar drops by 50%, then the number of dollars that you're going to get when you translate that Australian dividend into U.S. dollars will be doubled, right? Let's just keep it simple. Let's just say you're getting one Australian dollar per year worth of dividends from your company, and right now the exchange ratio is effectively at parity or close to it. I think it's about 90 cents. And tomorrow the dollar, now it takes $2 to buy one Australian dollar. Well, you take that Australian dollar, you convert it back into U.S. dollars. You have two U.S. dollars. So that's kind of one of the key reasons why we are recommending that people move at least some of their holdings offshore, because we anticipate a dollar decline. And so the dividends and the shares, when they're held in foreign currencies and you translate them back into U.S. dollars, you will get more dollars, and that will preserve,
right,
ultimately your purchasing power, which is what we're trying to accomplish.
I understand that, but I guess I was thinking more specifically in countries that, kind of like China, they're kind of helping keep us afloat in some ways by, you know, whenever we debase our currency, they follow suit and do it by just about the same amount. I'm wondering when they eventually choose to stop doing that, because of course they're going to. I'm wondering,
mm-hmm,
since it's going to, for any given good, it costs X number of units of their currency. When their currency becomes more valuable, that same good is going to cost fewer units of their currency. So does that mean then that even though our currency is lowering and theirs is rising, theirs costs fewer units, are we going to be, is the dividend going to also be lowered because it's now of higher value, because that currency is of higher value?
No, because again, remember the first part of the equation, the fact that you are going to convert those foreign dividend payments into U.S. dollars, you are still getting a dividend payment in a foreign currency. So if it's an Australian utility and you get, let's just say, one Australian dollar per year of dividends from that utility, that dividend is just a function of the health of that utility, which is ultimately a function of the health of the Australian economy. So the dividend payment is independent from the currency. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Does the same hold true of China, since they are debasing their currency just as quickly as we are right now, or at least close to it? Does the same hold true? If I'm getting the equivalent of say, I'm just throwing a random number out there, like say $100 or something, but in their currency. Let's say their currency doubles, so now it only takes $50 of their currency to buy the same good.
The same dynamic applies whether you're getting paid a dividend in the Chinese currency or you're getting paid a dividend in the Australian currency. Right now, the Chinese yuan is pegged to the U.S. dollar. It was not always the case. From July of 2005 to July of 2008, the yuan appreciated by about 6.5% or 7% per year against the U.S. dollar. And most people are anticipating that the Chinese yuan is going to have to appreciate again against the U.S. dollar to contain some of the inflation problems that they're having in that economy. they are so productive and they're pumping money into the economy that it's resulting in inflation. So they're doing everything they can now to halt that inflation. This is why they're trying to slow down a little bit of their lending. But one of the most important things they can do is allow their currency to rise. That will put a dramatic halt to inflation, and that will help their economy grow more productively in the future. So I hope I've answered your question. We've got to move on. We've only got a couple minutes left. John in Texas, thank you for being patient, and welcome to the show.
Hi. All I hear about on the mainstream news is how we're approaching the one-year bull market rally. Nobody seems to mention, ironically, at this time last year, the FASB suspended the mark-to-market accounting, which is allowing these companies to inflate their balance sheet.
Yep. Right.
So is it not true that if these banks did not have the shadow inventory, where they're just holding on to these assets, that if they would have to take a loss on these, and then without that rule would not apply since they would have to liquidate it?
What's happened is, if you look at what the FDIC did, how they've, you know, what is it, 130-some-odd banks that have been either shut down or taken over. Most of them have been taken over, but there was four or five that were just liquidated. And if you look at the mortgage backs that were on the books for these banks, you'll find that the true liquidation price is about 33 cents on the dollar. Now, you can kind of see where I'm going with this. If we were to say that those same kind of securities, which are on the books for all these other banks, were actually marked to market, we'd be looking at an entire banking system which is insolvent. In fact, I would argue that that is the scenario that we're facing right now, not only with Fannie Freddie, but the entire banking system. And it's kind of scary. I mean, if you look at the firm that I won't name that our previous Secretary of the Treasury worked for, they hold more level three assets than any of these other investment banks. They also have this kind of inventory, so it's scary.
Yeah, so without that rule, then they had to make that rule back then in order to keep us functioning, right?
They had to paper it over. They just had to make it look like it was okay, when the reality is exactly the way you see it, that there is no capital. And that is something that exists till today. It has not really improved.
And nobody seems to be talking about this on any Bloomberg, CNBC, nobody.
No, it's part of the status quo. This is the Main Street media kind of feeding you what they want you to hear. Now, it's something that can change. Hopefully, Peter keeps getting that word out. I mean, we are trying to do our best also when we try to fill in for him, and this show actually is coming to a close. I think we've only got a few seconds left, but that's the bottom line, is that you look at it from a very practical, realistic viewpoint, and it's amazing to you that that these analysts, these economists, don't get it. And you might think that it's a conspiracy that they actually do get it, but they aren't telling you. That's not the case. Anyway, thanks so long, and we will talk to you next week. This has been another issue of Wall Street Unspun. Thank you for giving
folks
us a chance to...
Folks, I just want to remind you again that all investments involve risk. All investments can lose money, even ones overseas. Not all investments are suitable for all investors. We encourage you strongly to consult your Euro-Pacific investment consultant or your other financial advisor to best determine which investments are suitable for you. If you want to reach an investment advisor at Euro-Pacific now, 800-727-7922. Otherwise, until next time, on behalf of Peter Schiff and Hemanth Kathuria, thank you for joining us on Wall Street Unspun, and we will see you again soon. Be well.